Well, 1 Samuel 18, beginning in verse 1, read along with me. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul went, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. As they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, "Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s." And Saul was very angry. The saying displeased him. He said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom?" And Saul eyed David from that day on. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre. And he did day by day, as he did day by day. Saul had a spear in his hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall," but David evaded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them.
Well, special thanks this morning to Carl leading us through that installation ceremony for Ryan. By the way, I need to get this out first. I'll pick that up in a moment. We have bookmarks on the book of Samuel. Aren't you pleased? I am too. Did you get one? Yeah? Can I get some help passing those out? I think there's some on the information counter out back. There's some there. Raise your hands if you don't get a bookmark. There are two reasons you need to have these. The first one is we don't want to keep them. The second one is there's a somewhat of a guide on the back so that you'll know what text is coming next and you can be reading ahead. I hope you'll grab a couple of those. We have plenty. Special thanks to Carl for leading us through that exciting ceremony with Ryan. Thanks to Ryan for being willing to receive that call. Thanks to the music team this morning for the wonderful songs that they have led us in rehearsing. Thanks to Rod for praying. It's just wonderful to be part of this congregation. And thanks to Ben Klopf, who designed the bookmarks. So, yes, thank you, Ben, wherever you are. All right, 1 Samuel chapters 18 and 19 are the text for today. If you want to use the Bible that's in the back of the seat in front of you, I'd encourage you to grab that. Page 241 in that book. And if not, just look on your phone. You can find it online, 1 Samuel 18. We'll be looking at these two chapters, 18 and 19, 54 verses, so we'd better get going. If you've ever skied Monarch or Loveland or driven through Rocky Mountain National Park or traveled over a number of passes here in the Rocky Mountains, you've probably seen signs marking the Continental Divide. You've seen that, right? And you probably know what that means. The Continental Divide is the invisible line separating North America into sides. It's this continuous ridge from which the waterways of our continent flow in opposite directions. Every drop of water that falls on this land flows either west toward the Pacific or east toward the Atlantic, one way or the other, depending on where it falls relative to the Continental Divide. That's what a watershed does. It pushes everything in one direction or the other. 1 Samuel 18 is like one of those signs that you come to driving through the Rockies that marks a watershed. This is the Continental Divide. We've come to a point in the book of Samuel where people are starting to make a decision. They're starting to take sides. They're facing a watershed. An issue emerges that pushes everyone either to the west or to the east, if you will. And that's just how it works. There's no drop of water that runs along the top of a watershed. A watershed is binary. It's on or off, either or, left or right, in or out. There's no Switzerland when it comes to a watershed. The stakes are too high, and the people in our text notice this. The importance of the issue forces them, God forces them, to take sides. The issue is what to do with this guy, David. Most people love him, but some people, one guy in particular, hate him. I'm talking about King Saul, who wants David dead, and he'll do anything to make that happen. Why? Well, Saul is the king, but he's becoming really bad at his job. A king has basically two responsibilities in this culture. Number one, fight wars. Number two, bring justice. And the Goliath incident has proven that David is way better at that than Saul. Fight wars, bring justice. Well, it bothers Saul and it makes him jealous that David's better than him. But what really makes him crazy is this, and this is the watershed, when he recognizes who David really is. That's the problem. That's the key to our text today. See, we come to 1 Samuel 17, the story of David and Goliath, and 18, the story of this watershed. We come to these texts knowing something that Saul and most of the other characters in the text don't know. We know who David is. We know that David is the future king. But once the characters start to realize who David really is and why he's having all this success, it pushes them right to this watershed and they have to answer, am I in or am I out? And we'll see that it isn't a choice faced only by the people in the text. This is a choice that we actually all face. Meeting the king forces you to make a call. That's what this text is all about. Meeting the king forces you to make a call. Will you accept or reject? Will you fight or will you follow? Will you love him or hate him? Will you buck him or will you bow to him? That's what Christianity comes down to ultimately, friends. What will you do with the king? What will you do with the king? What have you done with the king? Whether you'd claim to be a Christian or not, and I sincerely hope that there are some in this room who are actually just investigating. I hope there are some of you here. And if you are, you're among friends, and we're so honored you're with us. But here's the claim for you. And if you're a faithful follower of Jesus, here's the question for you. Exact same question. What are you doing with the king? That's what this text invites you to consider. We see it start happening right in the opening scene. Look at chapter 18, verse 1. People start to realize who David is, and it immediately drives them to take sides. I'm going to reread some of what James read for us earlier. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and wouldn't let him return to his father's house. But Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor, even his sword and his bow and his belt. The setting in this scene is important. This is immediately after David kills Goliath. That's what the phrase, as soon as he finished speaking with Saul, refers to. David, at the end of that battle, had a conversation with Saul. He's standing there in Saul's tent with this bloody head in his hand. That's the scene. And in that moment, something inside happens to Jonathan that changes his relationship to David forever. In that moment. Verse 1 says, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. It's a bond that combat veterans will recognize instantly. These are the two best warriors in Israel. And they're two of the only people who have the same view of God, that God plus one equals a winning team. In fact, God plus nobody equals a winning team. That's their view. And that view of the world that David and Jonathan share has pushed them into an experience that they share, the experience of battle. That's why Jonathan's soul knits to David. He sees someone just like himself. We live in a culture that reads this, and sometimes people suggest that there's something sexual going on between these two. Well, no, if you know the rest of the story that this narrator tells us, you're well aware this writer does not hesitate to tell the whole truth about David's shameful sexual sins. So there's truly nothing to see here. Saul was so impressed, verse 2 tells us, that he added David to his retinue. But Jonathan did something else altogether. Verse 3 says he made a covenant with David, and then verse 4, look at this, stripped himself of the robe, the armor, his sword, bow, and belt, and gave them to David. What does that mean? What's going on here? Well, in this culture, the clothes, especially for a person in an official position, the clothes represent the position. That's why robes play such a prominent role in this story. Do you remember how Samuel brought that word of judgment against Saul? The Lord has torn the kingdom from you, because Saul reached out and tore Samuel's robe. You remember the scene where David cuts off a corner of Saul's robe and he's stricken with shame about that? It's because tearing or removing an official garment signifies violating or losing the official position. So here, that's what's happening here. Jonathan is the crown prince of Israel. He's next in line to the throne. And when he takes off his clothes and puts them on David, he's acknowledging David as his replacement. He's saying, I know who you are. I see you now. I get it. You are God's man and I am not. And he's okay with that. Later on, he says, chapter 23, verse 17, you shall be king over Israel and I will be next to you. Saul, my father, also knows this. Jonathan sees exactly who David is. How? How did he figure that out? Well, apparently David's battle with Goliath showed him everything he needed to see. People sometimes wonder, where was Jonathan when Saul was making all those threats in chapter 17? People wonder this, right? I mean, Jonathan has proven he's a valiant guy. He doesn't ever care about odds. We've seen this in this man's life, so where was he? Well, it's possible that Saul forbade him from engaging. That's possible. But it's also possible that Jonathan knew his father's house had been rejected, and he's holding back and waiting to see if this new man, better than Saul, is going to show himself. Whatever the case, Jonathan's enthusiasm here certainly suggests he was just waiting for somebody like David to show up and take care of that giant problem. And when he meets the real king, it drives him to a decision. And Jonathan's all in. He knows exactly who David is, and he wants to be part of that. Verse 5 tells us this thing of success and battle becomes a feature with David. David went in and out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so Saul set him over the men of war, and this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Note that word success in verse 5. It structures the whole chapter, and it divides the whole chapter into three sections. You see it in verse 5, you see it again in verses 14 and 15, and then you see it in verse 30. That's the point. Jonathan sees David's success and loves him for it. Someone else sees his success, however, and hates him. Look at verse 6. As they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet Saul with tambourines and songs of joy and musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, they've ascribed to David 10,000s and to me thousands? What more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day on. Well, of course the people are celebrating as the army returns from battle, right? Saul and David are the subject of their song, but the comparison enrages Saul. Thousands for me versus 10,000s for him? And look at the question that he asks. What more can he get but the whole kingdom? It's so irrational. In this man's mind, the admiration of women is worth more than the whole kingdom. What's wrong with this guy? For Saul, the purpose of being king is to accrue personal glory. And if he can't have that, he doesn't want the job. So strange. Well, David's popularity stirs up a lethal anger in Saul. Look at verse 10. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed on Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. This was a normal custom. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul hurled his spear, which was not a normal custom. For he thought, "I will pin David to the wall," but David evaded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. And David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw he had great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went in and came out before them. You remember from a prior sermon, part of God's judgment on this self-obsessed man was bad mental health. David is tasked with the job of soothing his mania with music, and on this particular day, Saul tries to kill the man who's helping him. Why? Well, verse 12 tells us why. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him and had departed from Saul. He finally recognizes David as the Lord's anointed. He hasn't noticed yet, but now he does. Saul used to have God's Spirit, but now God's Spirit is gone. So perhaps for the first time, he sees David isn't just a great warrior. He's not just a helpful music therapist. He's not just a remarkably skilled shepherd boy. He is God's man. And Saul wants nothing to do with that, so he drives the man out of his house, verse 13 says, and makes him a general in the army. But again, verse 14 says, the Lord was with him, leading him to success in all his undertakings. Verse 15, Saul sees that and fears David. The people see that and love David. Meeting the king forces you to make a call. Are you in or out? You want to follow this guy or not? Well, Saul can't live with this state of affairs, so he hatches a plan. Eugene Peterson, the commentator, cleverly calls his plan murder by marriage. Verse 17, then Saul said to David, "Here's my elder daughter Merab. I'll give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." And David said to Saul, "Who am I and who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Maholathite, for a wife. You can understand Saul's thinking. He assumes that if he gets David on the front lines often enough, the law of averages will take over and he'll be rid of this guy. But for some reason, Saul reneges on the offer at the last minute. Maybe it's because in Saul's mind, public humiliation is worse than death. It's a missed opportunity, he realizes later. But happily, the universe is smiling on him this particular day, and he has a new opportunity. Look at verse 20. Now, Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, "Let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, "You shall now be my son-in-law." And Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David in private and say, 'Behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law.'" He can't even say it to David's face. He sends servants to say this gut-wrenching lie. Verse 23, and Saul's servants spoke these words in the ears of David. And David said, same thing, "Does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation?" And the servants of Saul told him, "Thus and so did David speak." And Saul said, "Thus shall you say to David, 'The king desires no bride price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemies.'" Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Same plan as before. Saul's other daughter, Michal, loves David, so Saul offers her instead. "You fight Philistines, I'll give you my girl." But David protests, like before, that he's not worthy. He has no standing. He's from the wrong family. He has no money. He has no future. And Saul says, no problem. In exchange for money, bring your valor. I just want 100 dead Philistines. You can almost hear the dramatic organ riff in the movie as he turns away and goes, ha ha ha, I've got him now, right? I mean, this is this guy's mindset. Verse 26, for his part, David loves this idea. When his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time expired, David arose and went along with his men and killed 200 of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter Michal for wife. I would have loved to have been there in that moment. When he walks in with proof of 200 dead Philistines. Now, there must have been one of two things going through David's mind. Either one of them makes him look amazing. Either he was thinking, 100 dead bad guys? I've seen this girl. She's worth twice that. Or he's thinking, 100? This is a warm-up. How about two? You know, you need to be thinking like Inigo Montoya. Right? I don't have to do him left-handed. If I use my right, over too quickly. Once again, Saul's plan backfires, and it becomes even more clear that nothing can stop David. Verse 28, when Saul saw and knew the Lord was with David and Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines came out to battle, and as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed. Continual success. Saul sees how Michal loves him, how the people esteem him, how the Lord is with him, how the success just seems to follow him, and it makes him so afraid. Just think about this, friends. How much anger and stubbornness and even violence is rooted in fear. And how easy it would be to be free of it all. If this angry man would simply surrender himself to God, which means fall down before God's king. That's all it means. Fall down before David, and he would find mercy. His fear and anger would evaporate, and his life would be so much better. But he won't. Saul's met his king, and sadly, he's clearly come down on the wrong side of the divide, and his actions are pushing him rapidly in the wrong direction. In chapter 19, the watershed that is David starts to push people away from Saul's own inner circle. Saul tries to destroy David in this chapter several more times, and each time his own supporters side with his perceived enemy against him. First up is his own son, Jonathan. Look at verse 1. And Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore, be on your guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I'll go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are. And I'll speak to my father about you. And if I learn anything, I'll tell you. So Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said, let not the king sin against his servant David, because he's not sinned against you. His deeds have brought good to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck down the Philistine, and the Lord worked a great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause? Verse 6 says, Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. And Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. And Jonathan called David and reported to him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. So the readers, like us, already know of Jonathan's love for David. But apparently Saul doesn't know that. When Saul tells Jonathan to kill the guy, he appeals to his father, and he uses three arguments. You see, verse 4, a logical argument. Don't kill him, he helped you. I think it makes sense. First part of verse 5, an emotional argument. He took a risk for you, and you loved that. And then the moral argument, or at the end of verse 5, he's innocent. Killing him would be sin, and Jonathan's arguments cause Saul to relent. David is safe. Jonathan's intervention saves the day. David returns to Saul's household. Everything is the way it was before. Until another opportunity for valor shows up, and David proves his mettle once again. Verse 8. There was war again. And David went out and fought the Philistines and struck them with a great blow, so they fled before him. And a harmful spirit from the Lord came on Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. And David was playing the lyre, and Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he eluded Saul so that he stuck the spear into the wall. And David fled to his house. Saul can't stand it that David is so obviously blessed. I mean, you just want to jump into the story and grab him and go, hey, jealous much? Right? I mean, just... There's an interesting parallel in the wording between what's in verse 8 and verse 10. David struck down the Philistines. Look at that. David struck down the Philistines, so they fled. Verse 10 says, Saul struck the spear into the wall and David fled. These are the exact same Hebrew words. Do you see what's happening? Saul's spiritual and mental health has gotten so bad, he's treating David like a Philistine. He won't fight the Philistines, but he'll fight his main man who will. David runs home, but Saul won't give up. So this time, Saul's own daughter Michal sides with David against Saul. Look at it. End of verse 10. David fled and escaped that night. And Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, if you do not escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed. So Michal let David down through the window and he fled away and escaped. Michal took an image and laid it on the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair at its head and covered it with clothes. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he's sick. Then Saul sent the messengers to see David, saying, bring him to me in the bed that I may kill him. And when the messengers came in, behold, the image was in the bed with the pillow of goat's hair at its head. And Saul said to Michal, why have you deceived me thus and let my enemy go that he's escaped? And Michal answered, he said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you? Well, I mean, Jonathan used persuasion. Michal uses deception. The results are the same. They save David from the madness of their maniac father. You can just picture Michal, right? Coming to the door with a positive COVID test in her hand. You shouldn't come in, right? Is that too soon? Meanwhile, David has slipped out the back window and he's running off into the night. The story is funny. And so I'm just trying to help you make it, you know, laughable. David's jetting off into the night and he runs all the way to Samuel, who is the third person in this chapter who's in Saul's supporters. He's in Saul's inner circle, but he comes to the aid of David, Saul's enemy, verse 18. David fled and escaped, and he came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and lived at Naoth. And it was told Saul, behold, David's at Naoth in Ramah. And Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying and Samuel standing as head over them, the Spirit of God came rushing on the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. And Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. So Jonathan uses the power of an argument, Michal uses the power of a clever ruse, and Samuel wields the power of God's Spirit. This is cool. Saul will not relent, so God himself steps in to protect his man. The location of Naoth isn't certain, but the word means habitation. And the text seems to demonstrate this is like a little community where all of the prophets lived together. As Saul's henchmen drew near, these henchmen are overcome by the power of God's Spirit, and they join in this ecstatic moment. So Saul sends another group, but the same thing occurs, and another group, but the same thing occurs. You hear the repetition in verses 20 and 21, right? They also. Well, look at verses 23 and 24. Him also, he too. Who is this now? Well, it's Saul. Look at verse 22. He himself went to Ramah. and came to the great well that is in Sikhu, and he asked, "Where are Samuel and David?" And one said, "They're at Naoth and Ramah." And he went to Naoth and Ramah, and the Spirit of God came on him also. And as he went and prophesied till he came, and as he went, he prophesied until he came to Naoth and Ramah, and he also stripped off his clothes, and he also prophesied before Samuel, and lay naked all that day and all that night. And thus it is said, in derision, is Saul also among the prophets? Obviously, friends, this isn't normal behavior that falls on that happens to someone when the Spirit of God falls on them. What's going on? Well, one thing is crystal clear. When the Holy Spirit falls on someone, the truth comes out. Saul strips off his robe, the symbol of his kingdom and power. And just like Jonathan before him, it's a tacit acknowledgement that he is not the king. But Saul's not doing this joyfully in love, like his son. His evil intentions are being overcome by God's good spirit, and he's powerless to resist. The narrator doesn't tell us what he was saying as he prophesied, but you can almost imagine, under the power of God's Spirit, he's finally speaking the truth. David is Lord, I am not. David is king, and I am not. I don't know if he said that, but I do wonder if he learned anything from this moment. All indications are no. He still comes after David, even after God himself stepped in and in mercy stopped him. It's like we're watching a living example of Psalm 2, right? Do you know that psalm? Why do the nations rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth rage against God and against his anointed, but the one who sits in heaven laughs and says, "Knock it off. Will you please learn? Kiss the Son. Blessed are all who take refuge in him." Someday, friends, it won't just be Saul. It will be every king and every kingdom and every individual who has ever defied or resisted or ignored the king. Be wise, friends. When you meet your king, it forces you to make a call. And Christians, take heart. This will happen someday. Everywhere. That's the whole message of this text. Meeting the king forces you to make a call 1,000 years after David. Another very simple man walked these same hillsides, and people seemed to split before him and divide like water. He did it on purpose. He said, Matthew 10:34, "Don't think that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I've not come to bring peace, but a sword. I've come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a person's enemies will be those of his own household." This is how it was with David, God's king. It's how it is with David's greater son, God's King Jesus. Friends, if you're not a Christian, I'm urging you to realize where you are. Jesus, like David, is a watershed, and you're standing right on the brink. And you will go one way or the other. Neutrality is not an option. People sometimes say, "I like to believe in Jesus. I mean, I admire the guy. He was a great teacher." But they don't fall down and worship him, which simply means they haven't really even met him. Do you understand who you're dealing with in Jesus? He said things like, "So that you may know that I have power to forgive sins." Or he walked on water, which is something that only Yahweh did, and he did it as a claim, not just a sensational trick. At his trial before his death on the cross, they asked him if he was the Messiah, and he replied, quote, Mark 14:62, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming down with clouds of heaven." Do you understand what that is? It is a bald claim to be the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Do you know what he's doing? In that moment, he's taking the throne of the universe by dying for his enemies. That's what he's doing. Have you ever met that guy? Do you know who he is? He is your king come to rescue you from all your enemies. Jesus forces the hand of everyone who came into contact with him. He's Savior and Lord. He's a wise teacher and the reigning king. He is the one who died for you and the one who places claim over you. You must bow to him. Or you can hate him. But you can't just say, he's a pretty good guy. And Christian friend, this and this alone is the Christian dividing line. There are no others. There are no other dividing lines. The watershed splits us all into two groups and two alone. On this side, we say Jesus is Lord. On this side, they say, no, he's not of me. And that's it. Those are the groups. That's the watershed. Which side are you on? Let's pray. Father, I ask that you would drive home to us the beauty of David in the person we see in his greater son, Jesus, in whose name we've gathered and now in whose name we receive this communion meal. Amen.